like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats are not going to win if we have a nominee who has a history of hiding his tax returns, of harassing women, and of supporting racist policies like redlining and stop and frisk. Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is, but understand this. Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another. This country has worked for the rich for a long time and left everyone else in the dirt.
It is Friday, February 20th, 2020. Oh my God, it's election fever, everybody. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. On today's show, Bloomberg takes a beating in his first Democratic presidential debate in Nevada. As Ryan Bort wrote in Rolling Stone, the billionaire had his ass handed to him in his first showdown against his fellow candidates. Elizabeth Warren led the charge right out of the gate. As Crystal Ball put it on her show, The Rising, Warren, well, let me let Crystal Ball tell you what Warren did.
Wow, she gutted him like a fish.
Gutted him like a fish, that's right, everybody. And Bloomberg looked like a fish kind of on there, like a robotic underwater sea dweller. Latest Nevada poll released early this morning has Bernie Sanders with a 13-point lead ahead of tomorrow's caucuses. That puts Sanders at a plus 14 in the Real Clear Politics averages for those caucuses. Sanders continues to take on front-runner status in state and national polls. Well, we'll see how this thing shake out after the debates and the results of tomorrow's caucuses. Roger Stone, good old Roger Stone, gets sentenced to 3 years and 4 months in prison for lying to Congress.
That's a felony also. You're going to the jail.
Yes. Trump opens the gates of Arkham Asylum, pardoning his crew of grifters and corrupt officials. We'll talk about Blagojevich, yes, and all the others. Eric Prince, you know Eric Prince. Betsy DeVos's good friend, I mean brother. No nepotism here, folks. Well, Eric Prince turns out, you know, founder of the private military services company Blackwater, you know, the mercenary company. Well, you know, they changed their name to XE Services now, whatever. But turns out he's under federal investigation for attempting to modify two crop-dusting planes into attack aircraft. That's according to new reporting coming from The Intercept. So, let's go right back to Vietnam, shall we? Little Agent Orange, and those never hurt anybody. My God. Today's PA Focus, Keystone Progress Summit is coming up March 6th and 7th in Philadelphia. You can find a link for your tickets in today's show notes. Click down there. We hope to see you there. Raging Chicken will be in the house. Democratic politics in Allegheny County went nuclear this past weekend, and the fallout of embarrassing media stories is still happening. Speaking of drip, drip, drip. The Allegheny County Democratic Committee voted to endorse a Trump-loving Democrat, Heather Cass, over labor organizer and disability rights advocate Jessica Benham. Because that makes sense in freaking weird world of the West. The committee also snubbed Summer Lee for an oil and gas and building trades-backed mouthpiece. Oh, yes. And it is true that the tensions between pro-fossil fuel unions and the building trades and the climate crisis is coming to a head out there in Western PA and elsewhere. We'll get into that just a bit. Sean explains the Lindy Lee saga. Yes, you need to know a new name, Lindy Lee, everybody. You can understand that saga that unfolded over the past week and why he was featured in Chris Brennan's Clout blog. And why David Dayen said, no, I am not going to learn who Lindy Lee is. I cannot do it. Leaders of ABSCOF, the union representative faculty in the Pennsylvania State Center of Higher Education, were caught flat-footed this week as the chancellor went public with warnings of major structural changes at state system schools. That's right before the budget hearings launched this week. In a letter to university presidents and in a blog post and media releases, Chancellor Greenstein seemed to say that the axe is coming. Apparently, he forgot to tell his new friends at ABSCOF what he was planning to do. Die, unicorn! Die, unicorn! Die, unicorn! Letter comes out then from the ABSCOF president to faculty trying to explain what the hell exactly happened and why Chancellor Greenstein is still a nice guy. And next week, a group of faculty, staff, and students will be holding a town hall to build on the newly launched Healthy Campus Bill of Rights. I'll give you the deets in the show. On today's Last Call, well, The Verge reported this week that a new deep fake video posted by The Fakening puts Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and Tesla CEO Elon Musk in the pilot episode of the original Star Trek, The Cage. Right? It's freaking hilarious, and I loved it, so I'm just going to say that here. And if you don't know what The Cage is, if you don't know what that first Star Trek episode is, I'll tell you a little bit, but you know what? You're just going to have to go watch it, and then you have to go check out the link in the show for the deep fake. It's really awesome. Speaking of Star Trek Picard still rocking it. Just saying. And speaking of Elon Musk, Tesla just got environmental waivers to cut down a forest outside Berlin, Germany, to build a new gigafactory producing batteries for Tesla cars to help combat climate change, for which the trees in a forest help pull the carbon, whatever. There it is. And Kutztown University launches a new esports arena this past week. I kind of got some raves and some boos this past week. This weekend, Free Will Brewing has some amazing releases. I am so excited. I have put aside some money to make sure I'm getting there. On Saturday, coconut chocolate sharing size will be there. That's an imperial oatmeal stout with coconut chocolate and milk sugar. And the coconut caramel cookie sharing size, the imperial oatmeal stout with chocolate caramel graham cracker and milk sugar. This comes as a follow-up for a collab they did out on Halloween where they released this sharing size. You might recall it's the can with the skull. These two new ones that are coming out, my mouth is watering as I'm talking about it. They were so good. I cannot wait to get them. I'll give you a fair warning at the top of the show today that the brewers and the folks over at Free Will saying, look, they do not expect these things to last more than a few days. So if you want it, get out there this weekend. And then on Sunday, yes, a special release day, they'll be coming out with the Benjamin 1832. It is the cream ale brewed with flaked maize and hopped with Matarina Bavaria. And the 1832 is based upon the Percy covered bridge. And that's what's on the can cover. And that's anniversary and celebration on Sunday. So they're launching along with that. Want to remind everybody to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Stream the show live at freespeech.org or tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And make sure you download the Rick Smith Show every day. The podcast is available iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcast. Or if you're on Twitter, go check out the live feed, the live stream on weekday nights at 9 o'clock at the Eagle Time. We're on, everybody. If you want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We're expanding our network as we prepare for the fight of our lives, the fight for the future in 2020. We're all in for that fight. And now we need you. We're not asking you to break the bank. We're asking you to become a member for the price of a good beer once a month. Help keep the media and the movement and the media. Become a member for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress today. Whoa, Sean, it has been an amazing week, I have to say. I can't even begin to think about where to start.
Yep.
Yep.
I think we should start with, Bernie and how he's going to win the Democratic nominee.
Yeah, you mean you don't want to start with Bloomberg and the fact that...
Wow, he gutted him like a fish.
We start with Bernie, if you like. That's fine with me.
I think Bloomberg's good then. I mean, it was amazing seeing him.
Wow. He gutted him like a fish.
I mean, I only watched the first hour of the debate.
Uh-huh.
I think that's all I needed to watch. To see, like, it was not going well for Bloomberg. And you could see why his handlers keep him away from speaking whenever he possibly can. Because he just doesn't relate to people.
No, and he looks like...
I mean, this is a presidential campaign. You're worth $60 billion, and you're going to go around the country talking to people and try to relate to them.
Yep.
I think over that debate, we saw that he doesn't relate to anyone but the super rich.
Yeah, and I think that came out. And that was the big question. I think the main question hanging in the air going into the debate was like what? How is Bloomberg going to do in here? Because Bloomberg was tracking pretty steadily upward in the polls, given the fact that he spent like what, 10 million plus already, kind of like on his campaign.
More like a billion.
And so, I mean, he's spent just completely buying out media markets. So the polls have been going up for him. So the big question was what's that going to look like when he actually gets on the stage, when people are actually going to have a chance to, hold his feet to the fire? And holy moly. I mean, literally, like right from the get go, I mean, Elizabeth Warren went right at him. I was, watching it. My daughter was there, so come on, let's go to bed. I'm like, okay, wait. And then Elizabeth Warren comes on, and my daughter's like, head snaps, like looks at the screen, is like, whoa, she's mad. It's like, and I think it was telling. And I think, personally, and I think there's been a lot of commentary about this too as well. That is the Elizabeth Warren that I've been missing on this, on the campaign trail. I mean, I do not think that her advisors did her campaign justice by trying to get her to tack to the kind of be nice to everybody in the unity message and all this stuff. That is her strength. That is why people loved Elizabeth Warren. That is why she's got such a strong following. And even some of her followers, and in these Times reported on this past week too as well, a lot of the people who are all in for Elizabeth Warren have been really frustrated and a little despairing, not just about her poll numbers, but like asking that question, where the hell is the Warren that we know? And so all I can hope for the rest of the campaign is that is the message that she stays on. Right. Because frankly, it's like, I think she does that better than anyone else on that stage. Right. Especially going after Bloomberg. And I think that's fantastic. I do not know if that is going to what kind of effect that's going to have on the race. I think Bernie is on that upward trajectory. And I think a lot of the people that were behind Biden and even Buttigieg for a while are now kind of looking around. And I think my prediction is you're going to see a good chunk of those folks kind of move towards Warren now, especially as the DNC is looking around for who is going to be that alternative to Biden. It can't be Bloomberg and it can't be her. Yeah.
I mean, I also think you saw that Buttigieg pretty much had like a plea for help in the beginning, saying we can't have the two most polarizing people. I mean, like, look at Buttigieg. He does not have any support outside of, like, white people. That's pretty much it. And then, like, he's not a viable candidate, like, after this. He doesn't have a state. He doesn't have a nationwide team. He's not expanding his ground ops. He's going to be done after – he's done. I think he's done after Super Tuesday.
Oh, I think that's right.
I think he's done. I don't think he's going to be an issue anymore. I think he's done after Super Tuesday. And I think Klobuchar is probably done after Super Tuesday as well.
We'll see. I think it's going to be interesting to see what done means in this context, right?
Yeah. I mean, they may hang around. I think Klobuchar's game is to, like, hopefully there's a brokered convention and win it that way. But, I mean, she just does not have the temperament, in my opinion, to be president. And I'm saying that through, like, the stories of how she has treated her staffers and stuff like that.
Right. Well, I thought, I mean, for me, as I think that what we saw in her response, I mean, I think one, and we talked about this before.
And she really resents Buttigieg's existence.
Yeah. I mean, I think resents is a diplomatic word on this. I think she despises him.
Yeah.
I think she cannot stand like people like him. And think the entitled little frat boy is kind of, I think, how she sees him. And she cannot stand that person. But the thing is I think Buttigieg, I mean, again, I think he is smart enough to realize that, like, okay, how do I distinguish myself from Klobuchar? Recognizing that, like, okay, Klobuchar clearly hates me, right? So why don't we just kind of like poke the beehive a little bit and see if we can get it to kind of like, you know, go into a fury. And he did that. And he kind of like, you know, especially when he's talking
calling
about
her an idiot, pretty much.
Well, I mean, he
called her out for not knowing who the president of Mexico was.
Right. Which is, I mean, look, that's legitimate.
Oh, no, that's absolutely legitimate. Like, if you're on that committee, you absolutely have to know who, like, the president of our neighbors are.
Well, you know, well, that's the thing, right? Is that I think that, you know, Elizabeth Warren came to Klobuchar's defense, said, look, we all forget names once a time, things like this. But the reason why that's important, right, is that, yes, it's true. We're all fallible human beings and all that other kind of stuff. That's fine. I get that. But if you don't think that interview where she couldn't name the president of Mexico would not be weaponized, you're crazy. Right. And the fact and then Buttigieg comes back at her, basically gives a little preview of kind of what that would look like by saying that, oh, I'm not just saying you forgot. Yes, we all forget. But you sit on those committees, the trade committee, the international, that's dealing directly with these folks. So you're in that position. So apparently that experience isn't enough, you know, like to actually get you to know who the people are that you're actually working with. And she could not stand it. I mean, she just like she could not. She had prepared notes and lines response.
She was about to throw her like binder at him or something.
Oh, I thought she was going to hit
lunch.
Him. I would have loved to been like they took a break not long after that whole exchange. I would have loved to be behind the scenes to see that stuff. Because I think
just called cock him on the stage.
Oh my God. And like, you know, I think it would have been like more like, you know, like a wrestling match with like, you know, some picking up the folding chair. Like, I was like waiting for that. She was livid.
Oh yeah. And then, if you're a Sanders supporter, best situation possible, pretty much going into this debate with all the momentum behind him. And really like this was your only chance to trip him up and stop him or like slow him down a bit. Going into Nevada, which everyone's already conceding, and then going into South Carolina, the next week's debate, right? Like, I mean, if he blows out Nevada, he's going to have another whole week of headlines ahead of him. And it's going to be harder to go after him, especially with Bloomberg on a debate stage for the next week. And, like, I mean, if you're Sanders after this debate, I mean, this might be the point where he may, like, this might actually be the debate where he skated through with no attention, and that might be one of the critical moments in this campaign where he takes a step in securing a nomination.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, the polls coming out of South Carolina right now, they have like the Change Research came out with one. They have Biden and Sanders at a 23% tie, with interestingly enough Steyer directly behind him. You have another one coming out. The UMass Lowell poll came out, and they have Biden at 23, Sanders at 21, so right in that same neighborhood. And then the most recent one came out from Winthrop, has Biden at 24 and Sanders at 19, a little bit less on that. Steyer still polling at 15. So, I mean, there's a real shot here. I mean, if you look at the overall average now, I still think it's what's Biden plus 3.7, according to our Real Clear Politics. But that's a coming out of Nevada. If it's a big win in Nevada, and, you know, having, you know, Joe Biden once again show up at the debate stage and being like,
"You're a lying dog faced pony soldier."
And that's his like strength of a kind of response is that, you know, he fumbled pretty badly throughout the debate when he got worked up about stuff. He just couldn't remember where he was going in some of his
I mean, he went
lines.
After Bloomberg pretty hard on stop and frisk.
Could
also, like, one of the things I forgot to mention about Bloomberg. Did you not mention when he talked about stop and frisk? Like, yeah, you know, we did it, and then we were asked to, and then we stopped. Like, yeah, it was a horrible policy, but when we asked, like, completely overlooked the fact that this was going on for like 12 years under his watch, and then like was kicking and screaming after he was forced to stop, like after what, like stopping 5 million people,
right?
Like, he just completely glossed over the fact that like millions of stop and frisks were conducted during his tenure.
Well, and not just that, right? He's just lying like bald-faced lies, because under it is true that stop and frisk started under Rudy Giuliani, But under Bloomberg, when Bloomberg took office, right, that increased. The numbers of stop and frisks, like, the stops increased.
And he's like, yeah, you know, it started in Giuliani's thing, and we stopped it when people asked us to.
No, and look, Biden was absolutely right by calling him out. Yeah, but when you were forced to, not when they said, like, hey, hey, Mike, you think you might be able to stop that because some people are not so happy? Oh, sure. I'm sorry, Joe.
No, it was when our Justice Department came in and had to tell you to stop. Like,
exactly.
And Biden was choking his, like, slipping his way through that. But, I mean, at least he made, like, somewhat sense.
I think early on, look, I mean, this has been Biden's thing, right? See, early on, you know, when he's on, right, at the beginning, he's got some things that he wants to say, and then he delivers them really well. And he did that, like, at the beginning part of the debate. It's just when in the back and forth, it's just, you know, it's almost as if, you know, I was talking to my mother-in-law about this yesterday. It was like, it's almost as if it's just like, his brain is still moving fast. Like, I still think the guy is sharp. I don't think he's like got like Alzheimer's and all this other kind of stuff that people want to say.
No, he just can't communicate it effectively.
Right. And I just think it happens, right? He cannot pull off the same persona that he used to be. And he's trying to perform the guy he was 10 years ago, as opposed to kind of slowing it down a little bit and kind of like making your case. And I think that's not where he is. I don't think he has the energy in him right now for that.
Yeah.
And it's, but, I think that's going to cost him in South Carolina, too.
But, I guess moving forward, like, holy shit, Bernie might win this nomination. It's getting there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. Yeah. It's like hard to not get ahead of yourself with this, but
yeah,
like, you see how like the timeline is like, I mean, he's pulling it out in. He's neck and neck in South Carolina. He's ahead in Texas by 10 points. He's ahead in California by 11 or 12 points.
Yep.
Like, I mean, like, he's going to win Colorado. North Carolina is just going absolutely haywire right now.
He's up by 4 points. He's up by 4 points in North Carolina, 6 points in Minnesota, right? And the lowest showing in California, right, is like up by 7 points. Right, I mean, he's been up by as many as, like, I think, what, 16 points or something like this, they looked last week. The national polls, he's ahead in all the national polls.
72% Democrats have said they're okay with him winning, and they think he can actually beat Trump, which is, like, probably a new high. I mean, like, it's – you see, like, the rallies he's holding. Tacoma, Washington, 20,000 people came out. You know, 10 or 15,000 people came out in Arlington or – Nevada. Like, I mean, people are coming out in places. I mean, it's getting to that point where it's like, if he goes big on Super Tuesday and he's ahead in the delegate count by a huge margin, I mean, it's going to be unstoppable.
Yeah. I want to correct something. I misspoke. I said he was ahead. I'm ahead by 6 points in Minnesota. Actually, Klobuchar's up by 6 points in Minnesota. My bad. I was reading too quickly through and skipped and kind of conflated the two. I just want to kind of correct that. But he is up by 3 points in Texas, which is what I wanted to really say.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. I just want to make that correct.
But no, I mean, like, you know, I think Sanders took a lot of criticisms from the previous campaign to heart, especially when it came to organizing in the communities of color.
Yep.
And you're seeing how it's paying off. He has significant support within the African-American community, and he has like a 50% support within the Latino community, which is friggin' ridiculous.
Well, I mean,
and he's like doing what we like that new American majority, like he's right. Really going after those minority groups, not minority groups, but those underserved groups within the Democratic tent who have been forgotten by a lot of people. Like, you know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
No, and I mean, it's like, you know, if you're the only person organizing the Latino community, it's no surprise you have 50% support.
Right.
And that's, people aren't going to realize that. They're not going to see that until Super Tuesday in the Southwest states.
Yep. Yep. Well, you know, we saw, you know, we talked a little bit about this before the show. It's like the right now you got Sanders polling, right? Was it 72% you were saying?
Yeah.
Right. And favorability rating of the candidates. He's like far and ahead by any other candidate in terms of national polls, in terms of like, favorability ratings. He is now, if you look at support under African Americans, he is almost tied with Biden. Right. So that, and if you look at, and if you break that down, but in like 45 years old and younger, and then over 45, like 45 years old and younger across the board, right? All races and genders, things like this. He's like 60% or something like this, right? I mean, it's like, it's huge. And then if you go the older folks, yes, that's where you get to see the older people get, the more that they're kind of like see Biden as favorable and see Bernie as less favorable. But then when you do the same breakdown within kind of communities of color, right? Bernie is got like, you look at the young folks, right? I mean, he is way out ahead. Yeah. When it comes to kind of support in kind of communities of color, kind of across the country. And, you know, I have to say, I think he was all, I'm glad to see that, you know, they were trying to come at him with the whole Bernie Bros thing at
the debate,
during the debate. And I'm glad that he basically came out and said, you should see how some of my staff, right, women of color who are running my campaign, and the kind of abuses, the racist, sexist things that they're getting on a daily basis. So if we're going to talk about being accountable, like for the people who are supporting us, how about we are all going to do this? Right. And he did call it the Wild West of the Internet. Right. You know, it's because look, there's only so much, and I agree with this. There's only so much that you're going to be able to say. If somebody supports me, I can kind of control them. Right. And he even went out as far during that debate to say, look, if you're going after labor leaders, right, that I disown you. Right. So, I mean, I never heard any of the other candidates being able to kind of come out with that degree of kind of like discipline of their supporters. And the kind of attacks that they're doing kind of on the internet too as well. So, and I've also saw this week, following up that debate, there's been a number of, say, in particular, women of color that are Bernie Sanders supporters have been doing screenshots of the tweets that they have been getting from people that are supporters of Warren, of Klobuchar, of Buttigieg, right? Just to kind of make the point, right? They're not doing it to say, like, look, we're going to go after them the same way. It's like, no. This is the way that this stuff functions at Twitter. And yes, it's bad, right? It should not be happening in that regard. But nonetheless, this is happening across the board.
Yeah.
In any case. But, you know, to go back to your point, Sean, as I do think it's like, you know, we're at the point where that this is...
we're crossing that Rubicon.
Yeah. And I'll say this right out. I said this to my friend Ben out in Las Vegas this week. It's like, you know, look, for those of us who grew up in the, you know, when we were kids in the Cold War, and by the time we were in college, right, and we were lefties in college, right, kind of like hanging out with the Marxists and the socialists and you know, you had like to watch your tongue, right? The thought that in our lifetime we're seeing a candidate like Bernie Sanders advocating for things that were literally unthinkable in a kind of a public discourse in terms of public support when I was a kid, or when I was even in college for that matter, it's overwhelming, right? And to the point where I can feel the constant pressure, right, of my history basically saying, no, it's not going to happen. People aren't going to do this. And every time I see the polls, it's a reminder. It's like, no, this is not then, right? It's time to take the leap. It's time to actually vote for something and not try to play some sort of prognosticator, right, some TV pundit in my head over what I believe that other people are thinking. The big question is for all of us now is, like, what do we believe in and what do we want? Not just, like, what do we think, what kind of crumbs can we adapt to in order to hope that we kind of, like, eke out some sort of kind of, like, you know, livable post-apocalyptic future, but rather, what are the things that we actually want as a future, and can we fight for them and say affirmatively, yes, I'm in?
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like that we're at right now.
I, like, 4 years ago, I would never have thought this would be a reality. Like, even after the election, like, Sanders would, I mean, like... I don't know. Like it seems like the train is getting ready to leave. Like, you know what I mean? And it's not stopping. Like, it's, you know, you've seen some things coming out with, especially with the unions, like the AFT chose not to endorse, and they put out statements like, listen, our members are divided, equally support Bernie, Biden, and Warren. And we're going to let the locals decide, which I think is a great thing. I mean, like, I feel like unions have played it right this year by not endorsing and trying to put their thumbs on the scale with endorsements and letting the statewide chapters and the state locals do stuff. And no, I mean, it's, yeah, no, I feel like come, you know, first week of March, you know, we might be seeing Sanders running away with this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be...
And there's nothing to slow him down from here until then.
Well, I mean... I'm always, I think, you know, I feel like I keep on tapping the brakes, right? I'm not on the campaign, but on my own caution, right? In part because the big question for me right now is that, you know, Bloomberg has come out and had said that, you know, he's not going to run negative campaigns or attack ads and things like this. The big question is that if he sees, you know, a significant decline in his polls and stuff, does he turn that kind of that, you know, unlimited, you know, wallet into negative attack ads against Bernie?
And you also saw Bernie holding back on Bloomberg to a degree.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Bloomberg. I think he was actually prepared. He was prepared to go at Bloomberg, and then Warren was just like, did a better job of it. I think, and I think he's like, well, I mean.
And that's the best thing for him because he didn't have to go after.
Yep.
In a divisive way where, like, it doesn't, you didn't provoke a negative response coming from Bloomberg because it all came from Warren.
Yep.
But, yeah. No, I'm definitely looking forward to this. It's getting there. And I'm looking forward to him coming to Pennsylvania. Like, I would love to see Sanders fill the farm show.
Oh man, I'll tell you. I think that once we get through Super Tuesday, I think either way, if Bernie comes out of that with like huge victories in California and Texas, comes out with a kind of like huge kind of delegate lead, or if he doesn't kind of, you know, again, like Iowa. Right, underperforms a little bit, but still comes out on top. I think in either one of those scenarios, I think we're going to see tons of him in Pennsylvania, because yeah. This is one of those places. And Steve Kornacki is already doing his kind of like, you know, like geek number stuff. What happens if, you know, Democrats win, or say, you know, like the nominee wins in Wisconsin and in Michigan, but loses in Pennsylvania? You could end up with kind of like a tie in terms of like. Kind of electors and things like this towards the presidency. So all three of those states are absolutely critical. And so I do not think that Sanders is going to kind of leave that stuff to chance. I think he's going to be everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and frankly, I found out, you know, I forgot to mention this last week, I think, is that like the DSA chapters that have been organized in the state of Pennsylvania are on the ground doing like absolutely amazing work. And they just, I might have mentioned this, I don't remember that, but they had passed a Medicare for All resolution in the Bethlehem City Council, for example, in the Lehigh Valley. And just last week, they also got that to pass in Easton. I believe it was last week in Easton City Council. Right. And so that means that organizing is continuing. Right. And when the focus shifts to Pennsylvania, you can guarantee that there are people mobilized on the ground, ready to hit the ground running in every sector of the state. So.
Oh, yeah. And this is where like the Bernie campaign staff, field staff is from.
Yep.
I mean, I guarantee you that John Smucker is going to be ready to do stuff. You know, all the people involved with the new Keystone Progress. Did you see their update?
No,
they're now PA stands up. So like all the major indivisible chapters and the Reclaim and the Lancaster Stands Up and New York Stands Up all coalesced into like one main organization.
Oh, so. I did. Yes, I did. I did see that. Yeah, I thought you meant something specific about Sanders' campaign. I saw that. Yeah, that's awesome.
A lot of important stuff happening. And yeah.
Big time.
Looking forward to it.
It's an exciting time, definitely. So, I mean, I mentioned a bunch of stuff at the top of the order, but the one thing I do want to put a little bit of a spotlight on here is that if you look at the pardons that Trump went through or he commuted sentences of 7 convicted white collar criminals this past week. And in particular was Blagojevich, right? He was the former governor of Ohio, right? No.
Can I make like a really like, no, is that Illinois?
Illinois. I was like, wait, I'm gonna get that wrong. Yeah.
Can I make a really vain statement?
Please.
I would love to have Blagojevich's hair. Like that silver fox, like,
dude, you're right. That
I'm
is
sorry,
really
but I was just like looking at his hair. I was like,
that's
man,
right.
His hair looks amazing.
Oh my
like,
god!
When I go old, I don't want to go. I would rather go gray like that than bald, and then just grow it out, like, and have fun.
Dude, there you go. You're gonna like get all kind of cozy up with Blagojevich, and you so you can say like, hey, so what's your secret? But in addition, so you got Rod Blagojevich, right? You've got Michael Milken, right? He was that junk bond king, right? And you got the former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick, right? Who were all convicted, right, on kind of corruption, on tax fraud that spanned decades, right? There were also four women who he commuted their sentences to. Their case is not as well known. There has been so much reporting on it. But I saw that and immediately thought of, like, the scenes from Batman, right? You know, basically say, you're going to release folks from Arkham Asylum, right? Because now you've got a group of people that are now indebted to you, and they're going to be your warriors. And Blagojevich comes out, and sure enough, he says, I'm a Trumpista. Right, he's like, I'm all in for Trump. So there you have it. That was quite a show. The other thing I'll just mention that I did not mention at the top of the line, there is reporting that is now set to come out that the there were intelligence briefings this past week of Wednesday night, showing that Russia is already doing the kind of like attempting to interfere in the 2020 election. What that means exactly, who knows? I'm not going to jump. Don't worry, I'm not going down the conspiracy theory thing right here, right now. But that did come out. That led to Trump basically getting rid of the guy who gave that briefing and installing basically a Trumpista with no kind of intelligence experience into that position. So he is like, you know, clearing out the way to bring in the folks from the Arkham Asylum and to make sure that they can move forward. So that's some big news to keep your eyes on. I know that there's going to be a lot of attention. It's going to be paid to what's happening in the primaries right now than necessarily, but also keep one eye on kind of actually what's happening to just the basic governing abilities of our institution. So what is that? Anything else in the kind of the national scope, Sean?
No.
All right, good. Well, I've got a treat for everybody here. I've got some new sounds. That's right. I got some new music coming from friend of the show, Ben. He has been hard at work once again, and he kind of sent us another kind of original specifically for the podcast. So I'll give you a part of that now, and we'll close the show out today with the full version. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I want to remind you to go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. I'm going to leave you right here with the special from friend of the show, Ben. Vote Bloomberg, peasants.
Bloomberg, Mike Bloomberg, I'm not Greta Thunberg, but I'll solve the climate crisis. Don't ask how, I'll plead, but I'm rich, and you ain't got shit to say. I checked one of my terminals just today. Wait, why are we talking? You worth less than that terminal, for heaven's sake. And I hate to say it, but I love to do it. Kicked grandma out of the neighborhood with the rezoning. Now billionaires like me own it. Ray Kelly, that's a big homie, cause he took care of all of my foes and tended to the broken windows.
It's Bloomberg peasants. My Bloomberg peasants. The Bloomberg peasants.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1868. That was the day that the governor of California signed into law the 8-hour workday. The law was the result of a strong organizing effort led by California's trade unions. The call for the 8-hour day had gained traction across the U.S. labor movement after the Civil War. In the San Francisco area, the Carpenters Union helped lead the effort. Other trade unions soon joined the cause. They held a parade in June of 1867 that saw more than 2,000 laborers marching in the streets. The marchers were organized in order of when their union local had adopted the 8-hour platform. Ship joiners, bricklayers, lathers, and more joined the carpenters in a public demand for a standardized workday. The trade unionists also organized politically. They backed candidates to the state legislature that supported the 8-hour cause. Their efforts got results. An 8-hour bill was introduced. Sadly, it excluded agricultural workers, but the bill was passed and was signed into law. In San Francisco, the trade unionists celebrated their hard-fought accomplishment. Workers from Oakland sent representatives to join the parade. The law went into effect 60 days after it was passed. But, like many of these early laws regulating wages, hours, and conditions, the law did not include the mechanism for enforcement, leaving an opening for employers to skirt the law. Soon after its passage, an economic depression further impacted enforcement, as hard times led many workers to take jobs that violated the law. Despite the legislative victory, the battle for the eight-hour day had not been won. The labor movement had to continue its fight for 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chickens Out the Coop podcast. In today's PA focus, we got, you know, a lot of stuff going on in the state, absolutely. Want to make sure that once again, right up top, we are going to be plugging the Keystone Progress Summit. That will be in Philadelphia on March 6th and 7th, and we do have a link in the show notes to get your tickets. That is, I mean, I think, look, it's an election year. It is probably one of the most consequential election years in my memory, I think. I'll put it up there. In terms of possibilities going forward, I know there's going to be organizing work that's going to be going on at the summit. If you could come out there, Raging Chicken will be there. And we hope that we're going to use this all as an opportunity in the state of Pennsylvania to get our serious organizing chops going. So I'm psyched, man.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We'll be in Philadelphia this year. Might have to make the trip cross state, but it's definitely worth going to. You might not know. And I'm definitely going to be eager to see, like, who the keynote's going to be this year.
That's always the big ones. I remember that, you know, that one year that we were out in Harrisburg for the for Keystone Progress, where you had – it was on Friday night, right? You had Cecile Richards came out from Planned Parenthood. She gave out the Friday night keynote address and just, like, literally brought the house down. I mean, she was un-freaking believable. And the next day – right, and the next day, this was before Sanders had launched his campaign in 2016. So I guess it was 2016, right? So before Sanders had launched his campaign in 2016, he came and spoke. The house blew up for him too, as that day, and that was, you know, it was like what, a few weeks after that is when he launched his 2016 run. And there was a third person too as well. I can't remember who else was there, but it was like it was unbelievable, you know. Yeah. And Keystone Progress has been, you know, you've mentioned this on the show before, but they've kind of retooled the way that the way that it works. They're really having a more focus on organizing and stuff.
Yeah, which I think is really great. It's not more of like the it's a lot more diverse now in years past. They're doing a lot more and bringing in communities of color and, you know, disability groups, and like having a lot more focusing towards that, and also trying to revamp it from where it's just like sit down sessions to where it's actually like doing organizing tools and really like changing the culture of it too, to where it used to be like a big thing of like, you know, this is where we're going to pal around with our friends from across state, to hey, we're actually going to learn stuff here and do this in an election year. So it's going to be a lot more organizer driven. The cost is a lot cheaper, I believe, this year than years past. Same thing like last year. Mm-hmm. They especially want to make it so people can be able to affordability and stuff like that.
I'm psyched. I mean, you know, I think it's going to be important.
Yeah, its registration is $35.
$35.
Yeah. So if you're definitely in the Philly area, consider it. Harrisburg, take the drive out. Definitely worth going to. And it'll definitely be fun.
I'm excited because last year was like, what, it was in Pittsburgh, right?
Yes.
Or Erie? Or was it Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and I could not pull off getting out there last year. I missed it, right? I mean, I missed that opportunity to kind of like connect with other folks. I'm so psyched to see this shift towards kind of organizing and bringing in a lot more kind of younger folks. I think that's exactly the way that we need to do. And the fact that now it's happening right in Philadelphia, that we'll make sure that we're there for it. So,
yes.
I'm pretty psyched. Very cool. So, yeah, so seems like the western part of the state was like on proverbial fire this past week.
I think if you were anything to do with the Republican Party out west, you had a really fun week watching what was happening in Allegheny County, especially with the Democratic County Committee, because shit was just on fire all week and people were just adding on to it. And when you don't think a fire can get any worse, people managed to add more gasoline to the fire. And I mean, like,
Walk us through what happened. Okay, so
this happened on Sunday, and there are still stories coming out today. So imagine, like, dominating the news headlines for that long. On Sunday, the Allegheny County Committee, Democratic County Committee, they had their endorsement meetings. There were people wearing Trump hats inside the as they weren't committee people, but they were Democrats who were going in observation. And like, you know, Summer Lee was tweeting, imagine having to go in front of people who are wearing Trump hats, get their endorsement. To go through this committee process, you have to pay $2,500 to be considered, which is pretty standard to how parties operate. I'm not really going to go against that. I think, like, if you need a well-funded county party and you want to ask for endorsements, you should be, there should be a fee to make sure the party can operate, function during an election year. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, there was some criticism towards that. But the fallout comes from the fact that the county committee, the people with the ward leaders and the committee leaders within Harry Reachall's district voted to nominate Harry Reachall's handpicked successor, who is a Trump-loving Democrat. Literally just the fucking Facebook feed was horrible with that stuff, over a labor organizer and a disability rights advocate in Jessica Benham. That pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah, I'll say.
Also, the committee snubbed Summer Lee. They endorsed Chris Rowland, who is a who's just going to carry the water for the natural gas industry and the building trades. That's who they're picking, and he already has like $80,000 in the bank.
Right, and I was going to say, so
they're going to heavily fund him that race.
Right, and I was going to say, it's not just that they supported him, right? But you know, the major drivers of the kind of fundraising out there, like with some specific, you know, like building trade unions, things like this, are already sinking serious cash into challenging Summer Lee, right? And she, yeah. You know, look, she came out on Twitter this past week in exactly the way that, you know, I was hoping to see it, basically calling these folks out, as basically saying, you know, look, you're basically coming after like one of the most progressive members in the House. You're coming after folks that are situated.
The first black woman ever elected to office from Western Pennsylvania.
Representing a primarily African-American community, right? And kind of trying to unseat her and put a white guy back in that office, right? And you're also kind of like going against something who's saying every scientist in the, like on the planet is basically saying we need to address climate change. And you're trying to get in there and double down on fracking and natural gas. So, boom.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, the funny thing about this, like, so going into this, you know, probably a couple months ago, I had a really good conversation with a Philly Democrat, and they were saying that, like, what's going to happen in Allegheny County should be a national story just because of, like, you know, the Civil War that's about to break out. And, you know, I think, like, really, like, what happened on Sunday, that did get national attention. But also, it finally is showing that, like, these people who are on these committees, especially out in Western Pennsylvania, they probably haven't voted for a Democrat running for president in 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
Like, I guarantee you that Bill Kortz and Harry Reachall, two Democrats who are retiring, I can guarantee you they didn't vote for Obama. Like, you know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, like, I can guarantee you that probably Chris Rowland, who is being ran against Summer Lee, like, he probably voted for Mitt Romney. Yeah, probably voted for Trump too. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
and these are who like these people have finally gotten exposed.
Right. So given that, what do you think is going to be the fallout? Right. I mean, both say short term and long term. I mean, is this actually going to finally unseat these people and get them the hell out?
So the election, like the county committee elections, won't happen until next year in 2021. But I mean, you saw like how much these endorsements have, like really how little these have mattered over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these endorsed candidates either got beat by the cost. They lost the Costas. They lost. You saw it again last year with all the city or all the county council members winning and just wiping out the Republicans and wiping out the Republican backed Democrats, pretty much. No, I mean, like, it's, I think what you're seeing is, like, finally a group of people, like, this was, I think this was a tipping point. Mm-hmm. Like, enough of these, like, MAGA hat wearing Democrats in our leadership, mm-hmm. like, as ward leaders or as, like, committee members or even as, like, county council members.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, a lot of these people were outed on in the newspapers over the weekend, you know, like the person that Cass was talking to was an elected council member for like a township and he was wearing a MAGA hat. There's a ward leader who circulated petitions for Adam Ravensall, mm-hmm. who's wearing a MAGA hat on his Facebook profile page. Right. And like, I mean, these are people like inside the city of Pittsburgh.
Right.
Like these aren't like seats that they're going to lose. These are seats that like your time is up.
Right.
And for people who needed the endorsement, like Ravensall, who probably needed the endorsement the most, the controversy around this just completely nuked, like poisoned his endorsement. I mean, it's not worth having after all the controversy that just spiraled out of control this week.
Right.
And then after days of complaining, the Democrats, the Democratic leader and the council person who supported Heather Cass on behalf of Reach All held a press conference and they decided to pour more gasoline on the fire.
Do tell.
I mean, it was just a really dumb press conference that they held. And then like they just start going after Fitzgerald for backing Summer Lee's endorsement or snub. And then also like comparing Bethany Hollum's issues with addiction to the crude social media posts that Heather Cass published in the past. Man. And Bethany Hollum was kicked out of the press conference beforehand. She showed up. They kicked her out before and closed the door on her. So she was showing up when she was live streaming and they kicked her out before the thing even started.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah. So,
so is it just a complete shit show?
Yes. And then the response from this came out yesterday. The party came out, condemned Eileen Kelly. Pretty much the Labor Council condemned Eileen Kelly for the stuff that happened on Sunday. I heard from a couple of representatives who were there as spectators. It was an absolute embarrassment. Like just being there was just embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like this is shit that wouldn't have happened in Philadelphia. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you show up to an event wearing a MAGA hat in Philly, you're taking that off willingly or not.
Or it's going to get taken off without your permission.
Yeah. Like, but no, I mean, like,
no, but that just goes to show you, right? This would happen. I mean, it goes to show you what happens when you kind of allow that kind of garbage to fester. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. What I was about to say decades.
Yep. Exactly. And so it comes out one way or another. It comes out, you either get it out of there, right, as a principle, or this is where you end up.
I know. I think this just blew the lid off of that over the weekend. I mean, this is also one of the largest counties in the country.
Right.
Like, you can't be having this shit happening. And, like, there's now calls for resignation from Lindsay Williams called everyone out by name on her Twitter account. Yeah. Kelly, Mike Doyle. Or, you know, Mike Doyle and like others have called for resignations. Connor Lamb went after Eileen Kelly, called for a resignation. Yeah, like this whole entire, this is boiled out of control. And it's really not good to have happening in an election year.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean about the fallout stuff, right? It's like, you know, on the one hand, like how much is that going to impact what's going out kind of out west? Like in some ways.
It also raises concerns, like how many, like, the lack of organizing that's been done out there by the party.
Well, exactly.
I mean, like, this stuff happens, like, an implosion like this happens after, like, just total neglect and getting away from your core values as a party.
Right.
Like, you can stay conservative or not, but, like, core values are, we're not supporting Donald Trump, but we're supporting Labor, and we're not going to be, like, Republicans.
Right.
Like, and we're going to support our party. Like, I mean, if you looked at these people, I mean, this makes, these people are the problem. Not the Bernie Bros.
Right. Well, you know, and it raises big questions about, I mean, we'll talk about the whole kind of organizing stuff, right? I mean, this is, I mean, let's remember, it's like the Secretary Treasurer of the PAAFL-CIO, right? Frank Schneider is from out west, right? And it kind of comes out from that particular area. So it's either points a finger right towards like, look, that lack of kind of like discipline within the broader labor movement in the state, right? Or it suggests that, you know, that they're just completely out there, say, running amok, and what's happening in terms of coordination in Harrisburg is not going on.
I don't think this has anything to do with like the AFL-CIO. What happened?
No. But what I'm saying is like this. I agree with you, right? But what I'm saying is like, you know, like as a labor federation, right? Is that
listen to the county Democrats. This isn't the labor federation.
Right, but if we talk about some of the overlap with some of the folks that are out there, right? So kind of what I'm getting at, right? It's kind of what go on there. It's definitely the Democrats, but I mean, it's like we're talking about the organizing that's going on too as well out there with labor too as well. It's like I think this is an opportunity. This is my point. I think this is a real opportunity for kind of labor to kind of like, you know, at a broad base, really consider this as an organizing opportunity. Because if you're talking about a destroyed, like, say, Democratic Party out kind of like out west, or at least in Allegheny County, right, it's like, you know, labor's will be, you know, the muscle out there in terms of getting out the vote and all this other kinds of stuff.
Which
they've always been out there, right? And I think that this is kind of like, you know, like doubling down on that and making sure that, you know, they dominate what goes on in the Democratic Party out there, right? The most progressive voices within there dominate what's happening in the Democratic Party out there, and basically be overtly calling, which has been happening on Twitter. It's been happening on Facebook this week. You see labor leaders are out there saying basically we need to get all these people out of the party and we need to get back to the progressive roots and standing up there. So this is kind of like, I think, a real opportune moment is my point. Right?
Oh, yeah. And especially like next year by 2021 to run a bunch of people for county committee to just have an ouster, like get these people out.
I mean,
I think it also shows you the weakness of like county parties for the large part, because it goes to people who are like this woman, Eileen Kelly. I mean, it's, stuff's not happening because of like merit,
right? Yeah, and it's like, you know,
I don't want to be like harsh, but like these people aren't getting these positions based on their merit.
No.
It's, you know, nepotism and stuff like that, and it's like you have to organize and get to be take these people out.
No, but right, and this is also that the kind of model. This is kind of the other part of what I was trying to get at there too, as well. What we saw in the aftermath of the 2016 election is that we saw a return to organizing at the county level, at the district level, at the city level, right? By groups like Indivisible, by groups like DSA, right? That's why we see Summer Lee, right? That's why we see Sarah Inamorato kind of getting those victories and ousting the kind of the old guard, right? Because of that kind of organizing. And I think that's been, and again, look, we're not unique at this in Pennsylvania, right? This is just more an opportunity to kind of reinforce exactly that same idea, right? Is that this is the opportunity that we to get back to that local kind of regional organizing, right? And not just what's happening in the capital in Harrisburg, but actually kind of be working on that kind of county-based level. Because if the fact is that these county Democratic parties at a county level are weak and this kind of nonsense is going on, well, then there's a perfect target for organizing to make them strong, is my point.
Yeah. And then we have the fights happening between the fossil fuel friendly unions.
Oh God.
And these Democrats out west.
Right. So, I mean, let me say there was an interesting article that came out this week in the City Journal kind of about this. And a lot of, I think, justified criticism of the way that the article, and not just this article, but other articles have been written, wanting to lump in, say, some of the most conservative or reactionary kind of parts of, say, the building trades and kind of basically write that as the labor movement writ large. That is definitely not the case.
Yeah, no. I mean, like, I think we also have to have a conversation that, like, the building trades this year is pushed for opposition to RGGI. Governor Wolf taking stands against reducing carbon emissions. They're pushing for tax credits for the natural gas industry, one of the most profitable industries in the planet, who don't need any more tax credits.
Right.
They're pushing for E-Verify, which pushes immigrants into, you know, the shadows. And like, this is not what like the labor movement is doing. This is one small sector of the labor movement. like, you know, and no, I mean, like, there's been opposition. I mean, it's I had a conversation with a Democrat about this. It's they're allowing Trump to divide and conquer the labor movement in these states, pretty much, like, with these going after these really conservative things. I mean, like, some of the people within these unions are saying that, like, you know, if Trump is Sanders nominee, like, then their members, then they might actually have to endorse Trump. Because of, like, because Trump will provide them jobs while Sanders is trying to bust their unions, as they put it, because of, like, his stuff on the Green New Deal.
Right.
Like, and these are people who absolutely have no one to be sitting at the table.
Right.
Like, they have no interest. And I mean, it's sad. It's like you're seeing some of these people, these union officials in the state, destroy any, like, blue-green alliances that were made up over the past year because of their egos and stuff like this, and they're bullying people. But no, I mean, like, this is it's really, like, astounding watching how they're reacting in the state.
Yep.
I mean, end rant.
Yep. Oh, man. So, but I mean,
like, yeah, and it's also, like, I mean, it's also the type of thing, like, how many of your members actually voted for a Democrat in 2018? Like, if you're concerned about your members voting for Republicans, what have you done to educate your unions to vote otherwise? Like, you know what I mean? Like, yep. A lot of these people are complaining that their members are voting for Trump, but they're not doing anything about member education.
Yep. Yep.
But... that's all I have to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there we are. There we are. So, we'll see. Look. I look at this. I was having,
and also, I feel like journalists should be compelled every time they mention the union movement in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And write an article just blatantly based on the building trades. Like, they should have to write a few articles on what's happening to the teachers and what's happening to, like, nurses in this state. I mean, like,
absolutely.
There's only 29,000 jobs within the oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania, while there's, like, 100,000 minimum wage jobs that we could be talking about, and how these workers are getting shafted all the time, or, like, about, like, what's happening in the Philadelphia schools. Exactly. And the asbestos issues, or, like, you know, it's the healthcare field, and now home healthcare workers or nurses are struggling.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of more workers in those fields than we have, like, in the oil and gas industry in the state, but they're sucking up all the oxygen in these stories.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I'm with you, man. I'm 100%
yep.
Right on that. Seriously. I think that's it. Because, you know, I look at this and this becomes all the more important is that we're talking about facing, like, literally existential crisis of climate change, of the climate crisis. And it's kind of right at our doorstep. And for me, everything is filtered through that lens at this point in terms of having to all of us to readjust our priorities and talking about, the time to act on all this stuff is now. And so I'm the last person in the world that's going to sit there and say, yeah, so those people in the building trades, tough luck for you. You're out of a job. No. That means bold initiatives at the state level and at the federal level that are talking about saying, providing direct pathways of transition for those industries, like, get them off the pipelines and into the kind of renewable sources and target those communities as the place to begin building that infrastructure.
I mean, there was a big fight in Philadelphia the past couple of weeks to sell PES, which
yep.
went sky high, back to another refinery just to keep the jobs. And it's just like, no, we can't be doing this.
Right.
Like, this refinery blew up.
Right.
Turned into a brownfield, like, convert it into manufacturing source for green panels and stuff like that.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. So there you have it. All right. So just a couple things. So one, I think I'm actually going to do on this. I'm just going to mention this here, give you a little bit of the outlines of things. And then I think I'm actually going to do, like, a special, I don't know if I'll do it as a members only or just a special release of the podcast, looking a little bit more particular about what just happened this past week in the state system of higher education. I was away, as you know, when we were talking last week, I was away for the weekend with my kids, my family. Had a good weekend and all this, and limited internet up there. I was up in the mountains, limited internet. And then the one time I did spend some time, so, okay, it's nighttime, not ready to go to bed yet. I'm just going to look at what's going on. And suddenly in my inbox, I get these these blog posts from the chancellor of the State System of Higher Education, Chancellor Greenstein, Chancellor McDreamy, as I've been calling before, and a letter that was a copy of a letter that went out to university presidents, and basically saying, well, look, game's up, everybody. Time it is. We're going to have to kind of make drastic kind of changes right now. And if the state system or if the state legislature is not going to kind of like adequately fund what's happened in the universities, then we're going to have to make some kind of serious rearrangements. And we're going to have to do them now. And what does that mean exactly? So just to give you a little flavor, this is from his letter to the president. It said the following actions must be taken by all universities working together and their anticipated results integrated into subsequent drafts of sustainability plans, blah, blah, blah. Curtail the use of temporary faculty. For example, striving to first engage permanent faculty to meet instructional needs, including permanent faculty at other universities. In other words, cut all part-time or all kind of adjunct faculty. Right? Eliminate low-enrolled programs. So, for example, consolidation of programs within a university by consolidating programs at two or three more universities. So, in other words, make use of distance education and cut faculty and cut programs at specific universities by making students enroll in kind of like a distance ed program across the state. Number three, do not fill vacant staff and faculty positions, including executive-level positions, or create new ones unless they meet essential needs as determined by the president. Right? So giving power to the university presidents to determine what counts as a particular need, and if there's outstanding positions that have not been filled, right, you're just going to cut those positions entirely. And we found it at Kutztown University. What is that? Just to give you a sense of what that looks like where I work, that means 19 positions. Right, that faculty have retired from, right, or have kind of left for other jobs at other universities, and programs that are now missing faculty members. They can't teach particular courses within their majors. They can't offer them because they don't have the faculty to teach them. They're basically saying those faculty lines should not be filled, right? And at Kutztown, that means 19 lines. So we have already been operating on kind of fumes, right, to be able to hold our programs together, right? This is the shock doctrine, folks, right? This is it, right? Right here. Now, that's the first part of it. The second part of it, which was probably even more enraging to me personally, was that shortly, not long after that, we get a letter, I think it might even came out on Monday, a letter from our union president at the state level, Ken Mash, was sent to all faculty members. And there's no public statement I can find about this, at least in terms of like on the union webpage or anything like this. So this kid was sent to union members, basically saying the chancellor did not talk with Abscuff about this. They did not consult him. Did not even let them know that these letters, and because it wasn't just these letters, this also went to, there were media releases that were accompanied with this. There was reporting on this. And the faculty union was caught completely flat-footed and was not expecting this and was not prepared with any kind of response, right? Now, this comes after, you recall, right, there was this big to-do about, oh, we're going to have this interest-based bargaining where everyone were on the same page and there's a new relationship with the administration and the faculty union, and we could all work together to save the administration. As I have been, as I talked about either last week or 2 weeks ago, when ABSCUF President Ken Mash basically said in one of his public statements to the Board of Governors that there's people that are harboring resentment, looking to pounce on problems, right? I guess I'm one of those people that was very skeptical of any kind of interest-based bargaining. And if you talk to anybody, right, who's done union organizing for a long period of time, and you talk to them about interest-based bargaining, right, particularly the folks that do kind of like, you know, rank and file organizing, people like, say, for example, at Labor Notes, they'll tell you interest-based bargaining is a joke, right? And it is used as a tool by which to kind of defang a union by kind of making the leadership of a union assume that the power lies in the leadership and not in the members. Right. And I've talked many times about how that we did not build on the power that we built for the 2016 strike. And instead, we were kind of, it was just like the Obama administration. Everyone got kind of riled up and ready to go, except in this case, we had faculty that wanted to continue. But then you had an administration, just like they did with Obama for America, the administration, the kind of leadership was, I don't know, we don't need to do that anymore. We're going to try something else. And so everybody went back into the little cubbyhole and paid attention to what's going on locally. And in the meantime, we see eroding the conditions. So that's where we are. And it is, I expect this is going to get progressively worse at this point, especially since the letter that we got from our union president was also clearly they didn't know what was going on. The chancellor then went and talked with Abscuff at the end of that week and was kind of actively listening, as we were told. And, you know, this seems to be out of character with the chancellor. There were still some kind of like attempts to prop up the chancellor and saying, no, really, really, he's still a good guy. You know, his hair is really good and he's a good guy and he talks well. We like it. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that, and I'll do a separate account on it. But it's going to be, I mean, this is a perfect example of what happens when we try to kind of go back to a business unionism model as opposed to kind of invested rank and file organizing. Said that. One thing I'm doing, speaking of rank and file organizing, a coalition that I am kind of part of and have been helping to kind of organize and build of faculty, staff, and students at Kutztown University. It's called the Healthy Campus Bill of Rights, where we're kind of, we have a Bill of Rights that we're asking the people to sign on to and help organize around healthy working and learning conditions. And that it doesn't mean just healthy in terms of being free of mold, like, which would be great, you know, believe me, in my building, but also mean free of toxic work relationships, of kind of sexist abuse of people based upon race or kind of sexual orientation or nation of origin, right? I mean, as kind of really about the community. Secondly, about the financial health of the community, right? Kind of advocating against, right, and coming out strongly for tuition-free college, right? So to kind of end student debt in the state. And then to actually prepare the infrastructure at the university for the climate crisis by going to carbon neutral or getting off fossil fuels by 2030. So we have a town hall meeting that will be happening at Kutztown University campus on Wednesday, the 26th at 5 p.m. in the Academic Forum, room 201. I will kind of, you'll be hearing, so you'll go to our Facebook page or our Twitter account. You're going to see information about it up there. Or you can check out our Facebook page by going to Healthy Campus Bill of Rights. Search that in Facebook or click on the link in the show notes today to learn out more about what we're kind of working on. And the idea is that this, the Bill of Rights that we're starting with is meant to be a starting point that we're using it as an opportunity to talk to different constituencies and different people across campus to try to build this out, to kind of say, look, the university's got their strategic plan of austerity and cut, gut, and punish. We want our own strategic plan that's looking forward to the kind of future that we want. So if you're in the Kutztown area, please come out on February 26th at 5 p.m. in the Academic Forum at Kutztown University campus. Check out our Facebook page. Like our Facebook page, Healthy Campus Bill of Rights. Leave your comments. Leave your stories. And I'm really looking forward to this as an opportunity to begin to think about the possibilities of organizing right in my own backyard. So, cool. Well, hey, man, anything else going on in Pennsylvania you want to hit?
Nothing too much. We're just stuck in budget hearings. So.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I've got a list of those kind of tagged that I have to watch today. So,
yeah, so.
So, the joys. All right, well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this quick break with this week's Last Call. Be right back. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight.
intend to destroy yourselves?
Just to show you how primitive humans are, Telosian.
We had not believed this possible. The customs and history of your race show a unique hatred of captivity. Even when it's pleasant and benevolent, you prefer death. This makes you too violent and dangerous a species for our needs.
Yes, if you do not recognize it, that is a key scene from Star Trek's pilot episode of The Cage, folks. And the reason why there, you heard me say up at the top today, there is the, you got to go see the video though, right? That is the, from the original Star Trek. It's a cut up scene, but what basically, people did is they, this group on YouTube called The Fakening, they use these deep fake videos basically to transpose, Jeff Bezos' face onto this kind of alien with his big veiny head. And then, Commander Pike or, Captain Pike is Elon Musk, and they have this kind of particular exchange. So I want to put that. It was just a total fun. It's not as thrilling when you hear just the audio. I get that, but that's just a tease of the scene. And it was like just it's just great. But it also is good for checking out to basically see how exactly how good these deep fake videos are actually getting. That it's neck. If you are just watching it as a casual observer, it is next to impossible to realize that these were not the original faces that were on those characters. So check it out. Anyways, I got some news. I got some bad news that I'll just share with everybody. I mentioned this a while back. We had applied to get into the Lehigh Valley's first annual podcast festival, which will be taking place on March 28th at the Arts Quest Center at Steel Stacks in Bethlehem, PA. Got notification this week that we did not get in. Apparently, they had they had an overwhelming number of kind of submissions. Only a very small percentage of people were able to kind of get in. We haven't gotten the lineup is not. Is not clear or at this point. They haven't posted it yet, so I'm going to be writing back to these folks saying, hey, look, you know, just out of curiosity, what were you looking for, what was kind of missing, and there wasn't a whole lot of information about what we should be actually including. I would love to be part of that Lehigh Valley podcast festival in the future, for Raging Chicken Press Out to Coop podcast. So hopefully maybe we'll even show up, maybe we'll be there for a little bit, but I just want to let everybody know that Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast will not be part of it, so it's too bad. The pitch that I made was also to have you're going to do a live podcast, right? That was part of what they wanted you to do as a show, and I wanted to have some folks from, say, the Lehigh Valley DSA, from Make the Road, and that would be our kind of talk about organizing in the Valley, and that would be our live podcast, and I have no idea if that was something that was appealing to people or not appealing to people. I have no idea if they listened to the key submissions from our podcast, if it was that they were just not good enough for them, or if we tend to use some colorful language that they didn't want there for their family.
Or they don't want progressives in their space.
Or they don't want progressives in their space. We were a little bit too ruffle too many feathers. Don't know. I mean, I just don't know what it is. So hopefully I'll kind of find out a little bit more about that so we can try to make a shot at it next year too.
We're not Pod Save America, okay? Is
that... No, we're definitely not Pod Save America. We're definitely not Pod Save America. We should remarket ourselves. We got Pod Save the Valley, and we're going to go up for there for next year.
Pennsylvania.
Pod Damn Pennsylvania. There you go. There you go. Just a little brief thing. Tesla, you know, this is just one of these mind-blowing things, right? They've been opening up these gigafactories all the place, which produces batteries for the Tesla cars, but also for their power walls, which is about saving solar energy and stuff. I don't know which. I know it's the car batteries that are going to be made in Germany outside of Berlin. I don't know if they're making the other stuff too as well. But the crazy part about it is that they wanted to build this gigafactory on this land that was a forest. Tesla went in there and fought hard to get the waivers, the environmental waivers, so that they can cut down a good chunk of that forest to build their gigafactory, which seems like is the most like contradictory thing you could ever imagine. That was a huge blow to environmentalists who were kind of fighting to kind of save that forest. But it also, you know, it also puts like foregrounds exactly, you know, and Germany has some of the strongest environmental policies out there for this stuff. But basically the kinds of choices that we're continuing kind of the making, as long as we have for-profit production of renewable energy, is that you're going to have companies like Tesla, you're going to have companies like, you know, solar, like, you know, solar companies that are going to be kind of pursuing policies that may be at odds with other environmental initiatives. And that's going to become just become increasingly the case if the longer we choose to ignore the climate crisis and refuse to act in a systematic way. So Green New Deals, everybody. Bit of tidbit. I mentioned this before. Kutsang University launched an esports arena. It got a big splash, right, in the Red Eagle and Berks County News. And it's a group of look. On the one hand, group of students that I know that I've worked with before. They work their butts off to get this and make this thing real. And they've got some esports teams that they're going to be running out of there. And so all kudos to the students. I went and saw the space this past week, and it's pretty awesome. You know, kudos to those students. But what's always remarkable that comes with always a bit of an edge to that is that the university's, you know, kind of promotional abilities went into kind of full gear to kind of promote this, and you know, there's all sorts of great lettering outside of it, and they're pushing out to the media sources and champion all this stuff. And it's so always going to see what's interesting, what the university will put its money behind and will put its investments in, what we'll pay attention to and what it ignores. So without taking anything away from those students who did this kind of, you know, kind of got behind this, and really a lot of this is funded from student fees. They got behind it and they made this, do kudos to them. And it's also a reminder the university could be doing a lot more to kind of promote good initiatives. So I'll leave it at that. Now, my favorite part, I've been waiting for this all the time, is that Free Will Brewing is releasing three releases this week, this weekend. And the first ones are these coconut chocolate sharing size, or there's the sharing size, which is kind of like riffs on one that they produced last fall. The chocolate, this is the one in particular that I just want to talk a little bit about. The chocolate coconut sharing size, I'm just going to read it for you. It's the Imperial Oatmeal Stout with coconut, chocolate, and milk sugar. The third candy stout that was designed to mimic Mounds bars with a deep, dark chocolate character and an unmistakable coconut aroma and taste that comes in at a 10.4 ABV. I cannot wait. I mean, I had their sharing size that came out around Halloween, and it was fantastic. The fact that they've got a coconut chocolate one coming out is blowing my mind, and I can't wait. I posted about it. Free Will was like, hey, we'll listen to the podcast. You know, thanks for giving us a shout out for this. It was awesome. But they did say, if you're interested in this, the last time they had sharing size, it was gone in just a few days. So if you want it, get out there. The second one they've got coming out is chocolate caramel cookie sharing size. Again, it's based on that same recipe from the original one. And to read this one for you, it is an Imperial Oatmeal Stout with chocolate, caramel, graham cracker, and milk sugar. And they got together with their friends from breweries in PA for Halloween this past year, which I was just talking about. Their first one came out was like a Reese's version. This one is graham cracker and caramel, as I was just saying. Again, that comes in at 10.4 ABV. So this one is inspired by Twix. So there you go, another candy one. So I'm just thrilled that on Sunday, Perkasie's got one of the oldest covered bridges in the state, and it's right, you know, they have these celebrations every year, and they've got a cream ale that's coming out called Benjamin 1832. Every cream ale that Free Will has produced has been fantastic. It's a great kind of sessionable beer. They will be releasing that on Sunday, in part as the celebration around the covered bridge. Yep, so that's the Sunday. I'll give you a little read of this one. That's brewed, so here, the Benjamin 1832 cream ale brewed with flaked maize and hopped with Matarina Bavaria, brewed with nostalgia in mind and ultimately desire to quench your thirst. This is a beer for all to celebrate. This takes on the widely interpreted styles. It highlights fresh notes, bright mandarin orange with a delicate sweetness and crisp finish. And it is. And it's a 5.0 ABV. Their cream ales are great. They're great drinking, great tasting. So do check them out too as well. But so that's all I got this week. This for last call, Sean. How about you?
Nothing too much. I am going to try to cook something tomorrow, so I'm looking forward.
Yeah,
to that.
You've been cooking at home quite a bit lately.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of Italian stuff, and then like using my crock pot. But I think tomorrow I'm going to make a chicken Florentine pasta dish. So like it's the type of thing where it's like it uses a whole entire box.
Yeah.
Of penne, so it'll produce a lot throughout the week. I ain't afraid of those carbs.
I ain't afraid of no carbs. Yeah, what are you going to do? Are you going to get those carbs?
Wow. She gutted him like a fish.
I don't know why that felt appropriate at this point.
But
I just did.
No, I'm looking forward to it, so nothing too much other than that.
Cool, man. I've got some chicken up here that I actually got to put in the oven actually when we get off the recording for the podcast, because it's got to cook for a bit today. So, which is good. It's like a, I forget what it is, kind of like, it's Cajun Jamaican jerk one. So it should be pretty good. Good. Cool. Well, hey, man. Anything else for the good of the order?
No, nothing else.
All right. I think it's
looking forward to, coverage of the caucuses tomorrow.
Yeah,
so.
Tomorrow's going to be awesome. Good luck. Good luck, Bernie. Look out there. I know everybody's going to be busting their butt out there in Nevada. If anybody's out there listening, we'd love to hear from you how it went and feedback. Have a great weekend, everybody. And we will be back next week, and we'll be gearing up for South Carolina. So pretty crazy. Another debate, next Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be gearing up right on the kind of right ahead.
Another good week of headlines for Sanders.
Yep, it's going to be, fingers crossed. Let's keep it going. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And as promised, I'm going to leave you with the full version of the Vote Bloomberg peasants. And Sean and I may do a little commentary over top. I will release the whole thing on our Patreon site for members only. So if you want to hear the clean copy, that's where it'll be. This is Kevin Mahoney and Sean Kitchen signing off. Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. We'll see y'all next week.
Terminal for heaven's sake.
See ya.
I hate to say it, but I love to do it. Kick grandma out of the neighborhood with a rezoning. Now billionaires like me own it.
Stick around for the second verse. It's fantastic.
Took care of all of my foes and took it to the broken windows.
This is Sean's first time hearing the whole version too, I have to say.
It's Bloomberg Peasants. My Bloomberg Peasants. The Bloomberg Peasants.
Definitely way too much time on your hand.
It's Bloomberg Peasants.
This is friend of the show, Ben. I didn't do this.
He has definitely way too much time on his hands.
Bloomberg Peasants.
Here it comes. Ready?
Peasants. Peasants.
And you know I promise this. I am no misogynist, but I keep a girlfriend. A girlfriend in every city. And you know we get frisky. I tell a baby be my NYPD. You can stop and frisk me. Yeah. Citywide tour with Muhammad, my man.
All right, I'm going to get out
of here. All right, man, take it easy, Sean.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
You too.
I'm so evil. How did y'all vote for me?
It's Bloomberg Peasants.
Because I got all this money.
The Bloomberg Peasants. It's Bloomberg Peasants. Zone.